This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Josue Michels.
Good morning.
And joining us from our office in Jerusalem is Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Well, the biggest story this week is that Iran has crossed a major milestone in its drive to develop nuclear weapons. To tell us about this, we'll go to Brent.
This week, the International Atomic Energy Agency brought forth two indictments against Iran's nuclear program. This is a nuclear program that, of course, President Trump has removed himself from the nuclear deal and increased sanctions on Iran. But Iran was still in the nuclear deal with European nations. And back in November, Iran said that they are breaking parts of the deal and increasing their stockpile of uranium, enriched uranium. Well, these two indictments that the new director of the IAEA brought forth, one of them states that Iran has now produced about 1,000 kilograms of 5% enriched uranium, which is enough for a nuclear bomb. That's all they need is 1,000 kilograms at 5%. Of course, that has to be further enriched to 90% to then produce a nuclear weapon. But the process and the time it takes to get to 1,000 kilograms is far more and far greater than the time it takes to get to 95%. What the nuclear deal was meant to do was to ensure that if Iran will push Iran back from this period in which it could race towards a bomb. And this is what we are, the threshold we have crossed right now. Iran has enough nuclear material right now, as stated by itself, to produce a nuclear weapon. All it does now need to do is further enrich it. And this process of further enriching it to the degree that it could be used for a nuclear bomb is only 3 or 4 months. This is what David Albright said. He's the president of the Institute for Science and International Security. He's one of the chief weapons inspectors of the past. He's a pretty famous man. He wrote this, quote, "It is worrisome. We didn't expect Iran to hit the 1,000 kilogram mark. I think people are a little surprised at the magnitude of the number. I'm sure it sent a shiver through the international community." And he's the one that says all that Iran needs is another 3 or 4 months to produce to get to that point where they would have weapon-grade uranium to put on a bomb.
So does this this development give Iran more bargaining power with the U.S. or maybe with the nations of Europe to kind of convince them to push against the U.S. leadership?
Well, this is always the decision that people are trying to make in analyzing Iran's push for a bomb. Do they really want a bomb, or are they just using it for leverage? People would say, and even the New York Times in their article about this would say, that it is just to try and trying to pressure the United States and or Europe to relax sanctions on them, basically trying a type of nuclear blackmail. However, the second report that the IAEA brought out, as not just the one where they've increased their amounts of weapon amounts of uranium, but the second report shows that they do have a clandestine nuclear program and they are keeping it secret. The Israelis brought forth in 2018 a number of documents that were stolen from a factory in Tehran that showed that they did have a past nuclear weapons program. They didn't just want nuclear fuel for their own power plants. They wanted to produce a nuclear bomb. Everybody knows that. And a couple of these sites that were declared by the Israelis, the IAEA wants to inspect. And over the past 6 months, they have put in 3 requests to inspect these sites that they've never even been to, that nobody's gone to and looked at. And Iran has said no each time. And so when we talk about this concept that, well, we right now, and we know that they're 3 or 4 months away, if they choose to increase the concentration of this uranium to get a nuclear weapon, that's what we know of. But they're going out of their way to deny access to other secret sites. And so we can't be sure that they haven't made even further progress towards a nuclear bomb. What we see is bad, but why don't they then show us further parts of their nuclear program?
Yes, so there could be a lot behind the curtain there that, we don't even realize. So for most nuclear-armed nations, there is great fear in igniting a nuclear war because the nation knows that if it uses its own nuclear weapons on an enemy, then that enemy would very likely turn around and use its nuclear weapons back on the aggressor. It's you know, this fear of mutually assured destruction that sort of scares most nuclear powers out of igniting that kind of conflagration. But with Iran, there's evidence that this normal fear might be absent. Could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, and I think this is something that we draw attention to, a lot of Israelis draw attention to this as well, because it is largely forgotten in Western media, especially leftist media, that the Iranian nation is not guided by this, as you said, this mutually assured destruction kind of idea where, say, Russia and the United States, nobody wanted to start a war or use a nuclear weapon during the Cold War because they knew the other one would fight back. But the Iranian regime is not that upset about somebody else using a nuclear weapon on itself, because all they need to do in accordance to fulfill their messianic prophecies is actually create a worldwide cataclysm that then the 12th Imam will return and save Islam and the Iranian nation out of such a situation. But they are not worried about what the retribution that comes from their attack. They are worried, most importantly, about pushing the nations towards this end of day scenario. And so that needs to be part of our thought process, especially in terms of biblical prophecy. We know that these nuclear bombs are going to, and nuclear weapons are going to be used. And we also know that Iran, in terms of Daniel 11 and verse 40, as this king of the south that pushes the world towards war, we know that Iran is the instigator for a war with Europe. And so, you know, they are producing nuclear weapons. We know that they have a nuclear program, and they are probably the nation that is going to be least hesitant to use it because they believe in this messianic idea that it is going to produce this worldwide cataclysm that will bring the 12th Imam back for them. And Mr. Flurry, our editor-in-chief, writes a lot about this in his booklet, The Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And it is something that is definitely worth considering when looking at Iran's race towards the bomb.
We'll be sure to include a link to Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, here in the United States, officials are warning that spying from China has become an existential threat. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Chinese espionage has been a problem in the United States for decades, but it's a problem that's getting much, much worse. Already this fiscal year, the FBI has arrested at least 19 Chinese spies, and they arrested 24 last year. So we're definitely already ahead of schedule to beat last year's record, and those numbers just keep going up and up and up as the government finds more and more Chinese people in the United States stealing corporate trade secrets, stealing academic research, stealing information on wind turbines and software and high-end medical technology, and perhaps most concerning, even defense technology. One of the U.S. government's top counterintelligence officials, Bill Evanina, had said that the long-term existential threat to our security is real, referring to, like I said, these industrial and military secrets that America has put so much money and manpower into discovering and developing that are just being lifted out of their hands and taken to one of America's chief geopolitical rivals.
So we could really see this play a major role in allowing the Chinese to sort of close the gap between their military power and the military power of the United States. Could you talk a little bit about the arms race aspect of this?
Right, because a lot of Americans really take a lot of solace in the fact that our military is so much larger and more technically advanced than the Chinese. We spend about over $700 billion a year on our military, where the Chinese military budget is less than half that, probably closer to a third of that. But even in terms of the budget projections, just looking at, you look at the congressional budget projections on what the United States military is going to be spending a couple decades from now, and then look at Chinese budget projection, what the Chinese military is going to be spending a couple decades from now, its current projections are that the Chinese military may be spending more than the U.S. military by 2035, like 15 years away.
Wow.
So you're looking at, within one or two decades, China having a military as large as America's in terms of money spent. And maybe some would say that the United States military would still be more technologically advanced, but because of this espionage, a lot of your military advancements you're making, you put the money and the research in for it, and they basically, that's what the espionage does. It just co-opts that the U.S. research departments now work for you, whether they want to or not.
Right. Yeah. To be the innovator and to be trying to maintain kind of a cutting edge, and always developing new weaponry as the U.S. does, is incredibly inefficient and expensive. They have to be spending billions of dollars for many projects that ultimately fail. Whereas China can come in after all those failures have happened and only look at the ones that have been a big success, and they can steal that technology and, you know, reverse engineer it and manufacture it themselves. So dollar for dollar, a Chinese yuan or dollar spent toward defense goes far further than an American one.
Right. It makes your military punch above its weight compared to what you'd expect for the budget it has, which is really significant. The Bible prophecies, what we talk about on this program, show no indication and actually that China will invade the United States. That's something that's not prophesied. But there are plenty of indications about these battles over sea gates and trade routes between the United States and China around the world. Isaiah 23 talking about this mart of nations that includes Kittim, which is an ancient name for China. And so you're looking for the fact, it's like, okay, well, China has to have the military ability, if you're going to use these trade gates in a trade war, to be able to like hold these trade gates against the power of the U.S. Navy. So you're definitely expecting that the military gap between these two powers is going to close to the point to where in places like the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean and some places throughout the Western Pacific, China will actually have the upper hand militarily to be able to force these gates. And something like this could really play into that. We have an article we put in the show notes entitled Why America Has Won Its Last War, which also quotes heavily from Leviticus 26, talking about the blessings that come on a nation that obey God and the curses that come on a nation that disobey God. One of the curses being that like your strength is in your military strength that's spent in vain, which also you can see echoes of that in this espionage thing, where you're spending billions of dollars on research, and I guess you do get the benefit from the research, but if your enemies get the benefit from the research as well, you could say that is a lot of strength that you're spending that's not amounting to much benefit to you.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. And staying on the topic of defense spending and weapons development, one of Germany's largest arms manufacturers, a company with a dark history of actually arming the Nazis, is now experiencing a huge increase in demand for its weapons. To tell us about this, we'll go to Josue Michels.
Yeah, that's right, as you said. But interesting about this is 2019 was not a good year for Germany's economy overall. You had uncertainties over Brexit, you had uncertainties over trade war between the US and China, and you had the sanctions against Russia, sanctions against Iran. So Germany, who is heavily reliant on exports, was in a bad condition, and they barely avoided a recession last year. But here's what the chief executive officer of Rheinmetall, Armin Papenger, said. Rheinmetall has had another record year. And if you read his statement, you can see his excitement in this. But interesting about this is that Rheinmetall has also a large automotive division, and that actually suffered a decrease in demand that hurt the company quite a bit. But what happened that they still had another record here was that the arms division of the company had large surpluses. So that's interesting. The significant higher profitability of the armaments division made up for much more than the losses in the automotive division. And I won't get into the numbers here, but I have another quote here from Papenger. And he said, "We are also well positioned for the future in key markets. In our role as an international system provider for armament forces, we are benefiting from the super cycle in the defense technology business, gifted to us by the pressing backlog in military procurement." So he's speaking about a super cycle here in the defense industry. And he's quite excited about it. But if you think about it, that means that the world is quite concerned and is arming rapidly, especially the Western world, which is the main benefiter of Rheinmetall's industry. So we see here that things are changing for Rheinmetall's benefit, but the world should be quite concerned about this. Now, most people probably never heard about what's going on in Europe right now as far as the defense industry is concerned. But this is a major event because if you think about it historically, Rheinmetall was Adolf Hitler's second largest arms supplier. And Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt at its time after World War II said that it's our inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and Nazism. Now, you may ask, why is Rheinmetall then still in business and running even so well? It's even more concerning when you think about that this was the plan from the very beginning. There was a secret intelligence document released in 1996. It was an American secret intelligence document, and it revealed that in August 1944, top German industrialists met with the Nazis, and they had a plan. They had a plan to restore the Nazis to power after the war. And a key strategy in that plan was that the German industrialists would go underground, go into the civil industry, and prepare for the third round. So, now we are seeing a shifting trend here. Rheinmetall's automotive industry is declining, and they are shifting more and more of its focus back into its armament industry. And that's exactly what they planned from the beginning. So if you understand that was a plan from the beginning, it should shock the world. But as I said before, no one really is paying attention to that because they don't understand that history.
So in light of that history, this is a really sobering development, I think, to see this company that was instrumental in arming the Nazis and the fact that they've remained intact and now they're suddenly shifting more and more toward arms development. The history there should make this just a real kind of a flashing danger sign for anyone watching it. And then there's also a prophetic element of this that should make people very concerned about it. Could you talk a little bit about the prophetic aspect of it?
That's right. And the late Herbert W. Armstrong warned exactly about this. Even just following the end of World War II, he said in an address on May 9th, 1945, "We don't understand German thoroughness. From the very start of World War II, they have considered the possibility of losing the second round as they did the first, and they have carefully, methodically planned in such eventuality the third round, World War III." So that's very scary if you understand this insight, because that's exactly what we're seeing. That arms industry, the Allied forces pledged to utterly destroy it and never allow it to arm Germany again. But that same arms industry is now arming not only Germany, it's arming all of Europe, plus many allied nations in the Middle East that are also hostile against America and against Britain. And that's exactly what was prophesied in Revelation 17, verse 8, where it said, where it says, "The beast that you sourced was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wander, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." So that's a prophecy that the same military empire from World War II will rise again and will even cause greater havoc in this end time.
So a very sobering prophecy there, and we really do see evidence now that that it went underground, just as is implied in the language there in Revelation, and that it's now just on the cusp of emerging once again. Josue has written an article that'll be going up on thetrumpet.com about this very soon, and it really explains the prophetic significance of this. It digs into those prophecies there in Revelation and elsewhere. The article is called "Rheinmetall Benefits from Supercycle in the Arms Industry." So please keep an eye out for that, and thank you very much for that, Josue. Well, here in the United States, the race to find a challenger to go up against President Trump in November is speeding up. This week, some big players dropped out, the pack got quite a bit thinner, and the lead position seems to have suddenly changed. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to a man who is kind of straddling the continents today, pulling double duty, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the just huge political developments in the race for the presidency this week. Quite surprising in some ways, in that about a week ago, I mean, when I was giving this program last week, I mean, it looked like Senator Bernie Sanders, the self-avowed Democratic Socialist, was head and shoulders above everybody else. He had half the Democratic Party behind him. The other half was divided between half a dozen or so more moderate candidates. And then all of a sudden, like Tom Steyer dropped out, Pete Buttigieg dropped out and endorsed Joe Biden. Amy Klobuchar dropped out and endorsed Joe Biden. And going into the Super Tuesday primaries, all these more, I guess what you call more moderate Democrats rallied around Joe Biden, reducing it to a two-man race between Biden and Sanders, and even having Biden takes such a commanding lead that it's not impossible that Sanders won't catch up, but it's going to be difficult. Mm. It would be difficult for him to catch up. And a lot of the political analysts are kind of looking at this like, wow, what just happened? Like in 3 days, the fortunes of the Biden campaign just swapped. And there's actually increasing evidence that former President Barack Obama is largely responsible for the switch in fortunes. Hmm. He was on the phone with Joe Biden right after he won the South Carolina primary. He was on the phone with Pete Buttigieg right after he dropped out, but before he endorsed Biden. And some MSNBC News is reporting that people close to Obama have said that, well, former President Obama said he doesn't want to officially and publicly endorse Biden right now because hedge your bets a little bit. If Sanders does get the nomination, he wants to unify the party. But he said behind the scenes, he's like the signal has been sent, I think is the phrase they used it, that Joe Biden has former president's blessing as the candidate most likely to do well against President Trump.
And that blessing, that signal, even if it's sort of unspoken at this point, would go just such a long way. We've heard very often among the Democratic Party that they just haven't been able to produce a Barack Obama for this election cycle. They've not been able to come up with sort of a rising star that has the charisma and the charm that he had. So in lieu of that, if you could at least have the endorsement of that man for the present candidate, that could go quite a long way.
Right. Yeah. Joe Biden's entire campaign is basically built on the fact that he was Barack Obama's vice president.
Right.
Bernie Sanders has some radical socialist proposals that make him popular in his own right. But yeah, Biden's campaign does kind of boil down to, it's like, hey, everybody, remember Barack Obama? It's like, I know him. We like, I was been to his house, but it's,
right.
But it is important. We have an article we can put in the show notes about from our editor in chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. America has been fundamentally transformed. That goes through a lot of Bible prophecies, especially in 2 Kings 14 and Daniel 8, about like an end time Antiochus in the United States, a political figure that like hijacks the nation from the inside and fundamentally transforms it. And it goes through the history of the Obama administration and how much it did change, fundamentally change America away from the constitutional republic it was established as. And it points in there that it says that as the Antiochus figure, he is really the political figure on the radical left that we need to be keeping our eyes on, and which makes it significant. I mean, he wrote that statement before all this Super Tuesday shenanigans took place, but even now you're seeing that even being out of office, he is still kind of the gray eminence calling the shots in the Democratic Party, saying, is like, okay, well, this candidate loves his socialist proposals, but he's a little too honest, a little too radical. Independents won't vote for him, so we need to start rallying around this guy who is probably going to be Joe Biden, who's going to be much more easy for someone like Obama or his advisors to advise and control and that position, should he get it. I think at this point, even liberal political analysts are predicting that Biden and Sanders are fighting over the honor to losing to Donald Trump. But it's we'll see how that goes forward. But we'll definitely put the America has been fundamentally transformed in the show notes, just to keep people's eyes on Barack Obama, where they belong as kind of that commanding figure in the leftist politics in America.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon, along with links to the literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information about these important stories. Coming up, we'll talk about sore losers in Israel's election, Europe's changing view of Middle Eastern and North African migrants, Vladimir Putin's plans for Russia's constitution, and the Federal Reserve's rate cuts. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In Israel, the Blue and White political alliance lost the election, but now in an act of sore loser desperation, they're trying to introduce a bill to change the rules. To tell us about this, we'll go back to Brent.
Yeah, this is really interesting, the story, because we even reported on thetrumpet.com, and so did everybody else, that Monday's election was a great victory for Mr. Netanyahu. And indeed it was, because his bloc received far more votes than Benny Gantz's bloc. You basically have these two sides of the, not even the ideological arena, let's just say two sides. One is pro-Netanyahu and the other is anti-Netanyahu, led by Benny Gantz's party. And then you have the other parties that kind of jump in on coalitions on either one of these sides. And so within the election that took place, you had Mr. Netanyahu receiving, and his Likud party receiving, 36 Knesset seats as opposed to Benny Gantz's 33. And this is, it's a victory for Mr. Netanyahu because he increased his vote share by in contrast, or at least the bloc did, in contrast to Benny Gantz's, by 500,000 people. This is about a 5 or a 6% change from the election that took place in September. Again, this is the third election that Israel has had to try and break this political deadlock between these parties. And so this was a really big groundswell of support for Mr. Netanyahu, the first time in the past three elections that his party has beaten Benny Gantz's party and had done it in a very decisive manner. However, because of some of the other seats that were lost by some of his coalition partners, he cannot make up the majority in the Knesset. You need a full 60 votes to get majority, or 61 to have a majority in the 120-seat Knesset. And so his bloc only makes up 58. He still was the leading vote getter. But now, because Mr. Netanyahu can't make up the full 60, what would normally happen is he would still have the opportunity to try and cobble together a coalition. But instead, Blue and White is coming together to bring together other parties to try and pass a bill, a new law, which would be passed in this kind of like interim Knesset. Basically, everyone's going to get sworn in a few days and into the government, and then they're going to have time to figure out who's the actual prime minister. But in the meantime, Benny Gantz is going to propose this law that will restrict a sitting member of the Knesset that's under indictment from bringing together a government. And of course, the Prime Minister Netanyahu is under indictment right now for bribery, breach of trust, and other things that have not been proven guilty. And right now, as the Prime Minister, he can bring forward a government even under those indictments because they haven't been proven yet. And so Benny Gantz has now decided that he's going to bring together the left party, his party, Avigdor Lieberman's party, which he is like so far on the right, but he just hates Netanyahu, so he doesn't want to go into a government with Netanyahu, and the Arab List. This is a group of 15 politicians or 15 members of the Knesset from this next vote, and they're that all together. That group makes up 62. The only which is a majority. The only thing that unites them is a shared hatred for Prime Minister Netanyahu. And they are going to try and pass this bill that basically is an anti-Netanyahu bill. And in the process, annulling a good 48% of Israel's voting voters, which said that they would like Netanyahu to be prime minister. And so this is where it's going in Israeli democracy. And it's really worrying a lot of people that it's becoming even more... these political sides are getting even more further apart than we've seen even in the past.
So does it look like this bill has a good chance of being passed?
So far, it looks like it could pass. However, it is kind of locking Benny Gantz into a very dangerous position because it's showing that he is willing to work with the Arab parties in the Knesset, those that are very much anti-Zionist, against the state of Israel. He's willing to put a closer relationship with them before accepting the will of 48% of the Israeli public. And so the reason he won't be able to actually form a government, that is Benny Gantz, is because he doesn't want to form a government where he is in coalition with the Arab parties, because his Jewish voters that voted for him don't want that. And so he would be setting himself up for failure in the future if the bill passes, because his government would soon lose power, because he would have deserters his voters would be deserting from him very fast because of his collusion with the Arab parties. And so it's really interesting to look at this, because you try and read Israeli media and you're trying to find an unbiased voice out there. I do. I'm trying to find somebody that understands that, you know, 48% of the Israeli public's will now is being disannulled with this creation of a law that's just for this, and it's just reeks of anti-democracy. And yet, the media is portraying Netanyahu as the one that's trying to get rid of democracy in Israel, and so it does seem pretty strange. We'll see how it goes. I don't know. I still think Netanyahu might be able to swing together some type of coalition by perhaps getting some defectors from these other parties. We'll see. But in terms of biblical prophecy, what we're seeing in the nations of Israel, this nation of Judah, which is called modern Israel today, what we're seeing in the United States, what we're seeing in Britain, in many ways, it is the leftist media establishment, the intellectual class, that is going against the will of the people, and it is bitterly dividing the nation. In terms of it's hard to see how this, even if Benny Gantz can pass this law, how this brings the nation together, considering 48% of the nation would feel betrayed. And that's the biblically prophesied state of our nations in this end time. They're not going to be closely working together. They are going to become more and more there's going to be a fracture of society where the enemies come from within, and that people will not be able to get along. And Jesus Christ said, a house divided itself cannot stand. And this is what we're seeing in all three of these nations of Israel, this modern nation of Israel included.
Any literature you would recommend to listeners who would want to understand more about that Bible prophecy context?
Yeah, I think what would be really good for people to understand what the trend that's going on here is to request the Ezekiel booklet. One of the early chapters in that book talks about the bitter divisions that exist within our nations and how really God is the only one that's going to solve them.
Well, we'll be sure to include a link to Mr. Fleury's book, Ezekiel's End Time Prophet, in the show notes, a very powerful book that we give away free for anyone who would like to read it. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll go back to Europe for a look at the way Europeans see migrants from the Middle East and North Africa who are moving into the continent. For this, we'll go back to Josue.
Yes, so in 2015... it was definitely a momentous year for all of Europe, and they won't forget that year. It was a time when millions of refugees from Africa and the Middle East embarked on their journey to Europe. It was a time when Chancellor Angela Merkel decided to open Germany's borders and hoped that all the other European countries would follow suit. It was a time when many humanitarian aid organizations opened their arms, and many, many Europeans welcomed the refugees, when pictures of refugees at the border really pricked the hearts of many people, and the emotions were high at that point. But now we are seeing a similar situation at Europe's borders, but the reaction of Europeans is quite different. Greece didn't open its borders this time to welcome the refugees, and the European Union backed Greece's decision. So what led up to this was that the Turkish President Erdogan decided to open the borders and let the migrants go. It was largely due to Turkey's efforts before that another refugee wave was prevented. That was agreement between the European Union and Turkey that he would halt the migrants in Turkey and be given financial aid for that. But he has changed his mind now. Turkey is in a very dire economic situation, and they want to money to flow directly to them instead of to the humanitarian aid organization, and they want Europe's help in Syria. So he was trying to press Europe to help him with that, but they really didn't care too much anymore about the refugees at their borders and said, we won't take them in. We will still expect that Europe will get involved more in Syria, but it's also interesting to observe how Europe responded. The pictures of drowning migrants and refugees doesn't really bother Europeans that much anymore. I have an article here from Germany's newspaper Die Zeit, and they said, Europe loses its soul at the border. The Belgian newspaper The Standard said the European heart has become very cold. And they are contrasting what happened between the years of 2015 and 2020. Lots has changed in Europe. The European leadership has changed. Far-right movements have grown, and European heads of states have become much more radical and much more far-right. So we are seeing quite a different reaction between 2015 and 2020.
So could you talk a little bit about why this is happening? Why is this coldness kind of setting in the European heart? Is it just a matter of they feel that they've been overrun, so their sympathies have been exhausted?
Yes, part of that is certainly that, and they also have been desensitized to the images. If you hear news 5 years of drowning refugees, people are moved in the beginning, but they kind of drowned out those news. But also interesting to think about is what happened in Europe since. When the first wave of refugees came, many Europeans welcomed them, but there were quite a few who, for example, set refugee centers ablaze, attacked migrants. So that were horrible news that kind of shed a bad light on Europeans, and they don't want that to repeat. But also there were many refugees that didn't behave, they didn't appreciate what they had, We had terrorist attacks. We had migrant groups form. We had migrant gangs form. And there were many women were raped in Germany and other European countries. So those things really upset many Europeans. And you can see why they don't want millions of refugees flooding into their country again.
For sure, yeah. Having seen what happened with the first wave, it's perfectly understandable why there would be quite a bit of reluctance now to just swing the border doors open and let others in. Would you be able to place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just let listeners know where they could go to read more to find out about that?
Yes, so there's this contrast between 2015 and 2020 is quite shocking to see that Europeans don't really feel for those migrants and refugees anymore is quite shocking, but it's exactly what we expected when we look at Bible prophecy. Revelation 17 talks about 10 European leaders come up that act more like dictators than Democrats, and the refugee crisis really has moved the people to accept leaders that take strong actions. They want the crisis to be taken care of. They want the borders to be closed when it has to be closed, that they can live in peace. So they are accepting those leaders to come up. And that's exactly what we expected when we are looking at it. And the prophecy in Psalm 83 and Daniel 11 talks about that Europe will take military action in the Middle East to prevent another refugee crisis, to really get these things settled out, to ally with Turkey. And that's exactly what Psalm 83 prophesies and what Turkey is in the moment demanding. Our editor-in-chief, Jeff Louis, has a booklet, The King of the South, that explains all these prophecies that we are now seeing as they come to pass.
Okay, we'll be sure to include a link to that booklet, The King of the South. Thanks very much for that, Josue. Well, for our next story, we'll take a look at Russia, where the president is making some interesting amendments to the Constitution. For this, we'll turn it back over to Andrew.
Yes, Russian President Vladimir Putin has proposed quite the series of constitutional amendments that are soon to be put to a vote. I think it's something like a popular referendum to see which of these has public support and which of them doesn't. But amongst the amendments Putin's proposed are a constitutional proclamation of Russia's faith in God, a constitutional definition of marriage as being between one man and one woman, an official ban on giving away any Russian territory, a proposal criminalizing the denial of Russia's role in the Allied victory in World War II, and a proposal to create an advisory body called the State Council. Still not a lot of details on what that State Council would perform, but there are a number of political analysts that think that last amendment might be the core reason he's proposing these amendments in the first place. Putin, having been the dominant figure in Russian politics for two decades, coming to the end of his last legal term in the presidency, unless they amend the Constitution to allow him to be elected president again. But this proposal for the State Council, that it may be a way for Putin to join that council and rule Russia from another position, putting someone in the presidency who'd be subservient to that position he holds. We'll see going forward the significance of these government structures in changing. But many of these other amendments, such as, a proclamation of Russia's faith in God and defining marriage as between one man and one woman, there are political analysts who see this as kind of, put these in amongst the other amendments to increase the popularity of the package. A lot of Putin's supporters are a very devout Russian Orthodox people. So if they hear there's a, see all the headlines about like, oh, well, we're going to define marriages between one man and one woman, you're like, well, that's what the Bible says. It's like, that's a great constitutional amendment. Let's vote for that. And maybe not give so much thought to the other amendments bundled in that about a new state council that would allow Putin to stay on as the powerful figure in Russian politics for years to come.
Yeah, so that's a brilliant strategy, really, to kind of bundle it all together. You have some of these proposals that would be overwhelmingly popular, and then tied to it is this quiet little mention of, by the way, we are going to enshrine the office of state council head into the Constitution. So that Putin could very likely assume that office in 2024 once he, you know, his presidential term ends. It's an interesting strategy. You know what really strikes me, though, about this, when you mention faith in God in the Constitution and talking about traditional family values and defining marriage in a traditional way, it just really makes you think about how much the tables have turned since the Cold War. Because in those days, the conflict was often seen as, you know, the God-fearing Christian Americans versus the godless Soviet Union atheists. But now, 30 years after the Cold War ended, the U.S. and Europe have kind of become far less religious, and Russia, meanwhile, has taken up the mantle of Christianity. Putin's trying to portray Russia as a bastion, really, of traditional marriage and family values and Christian faith. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it is a weird, because if you go back 100 years when Bolshevik Revolution time, I mean, the Lenin declared Russia officially atheist state. It was one of the first nations in the world to decriminalize homosexuality. The original Bolsheviks, they were like the radical left is in America today, with just tearing down family values. And then after just decades of living under this horrible tyrannical system, there did seem to be a backlash to where, in some ways, I mean, the Russian Orthodox Church doesn't have the same respect for freedom of religion and freedom as conscious as America does. They're trying to legislate morality when morality, God wants it to be a personal choice you make with him. But it does also bring to mind the verse in Isaiah where God says he's punishing the descendants of end time Israel, America, and Britain because they've sinned more than all the nations around them. And then today, like, I think President George Bush proposed an amendment to define a constitutional amendment to define marriages between one man and one woman, and just totally had it like laughed out of Congress. For on that particular Bible doctrine, the Russians are standing up for that morality in a way America is not. And like I said, it is kind of an ironic turn of the tables. But then, like I said, when you look at this whole package with the state council amendment and all that, it also is fulfilling the primary prophecy we're looking at in this situation in Ezekiel 38, where it talks about Son of Man speak against the prince of Rosh, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, these countries, the Meshach being the Meshka tribe that builded Moscow, and Tubal being a related tribe on the other side of the Ural Mountains, these peoples that biblical peoples that settled Russia, and now this end time prophecy about a prince who's like rise up in this nation and fulfill a role with more power than just a regularly democratic elected president, that it looks that like our editor-in-chief has very strongly indicated that Vladimir Putin could be that prince, and even in the off chance that he's not, he's definitely making the constitutional amendments that a prince like that is going to need to rule this power block talked about in Ezekiel 38.
Mr. Fleury has written a booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia that really goes into that prophecy in Ezekiel 38 in quite a lot of depth and ties in many related prophecies in Revelation and Daniel and elsewhere. So We'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes for today's episode. Thanks very much for filling us in on that, Andrew. And actually, for our final story today, we'll stick with Andrew here for an update on the latest news about the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. What can you tell us about that, Andrew?
Yeah, early this week, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by half a percentage point, which is pretty big news because this is the first time since the 2008 financial crisis that the Federal Reserve has done an emergency interest rate cut. Now, usually they've cut interest rates plenty of times before, but they've always done it at an official meeting of the Federal Reserve. This wasn't done at a meeting. They're like, we can't wait till the next meeting. We have to cut this now to give the economy a shock. It was largely due to the fears of the coronavirus caused a stock market downturn. Worst stock market had its worst week. The last week in February was its worst week since the 2008 financial crisis. And so they're like, well, no, we need to cut these interest rates by half a percentage point. They cut them down to where the Fed interest rate's only 1% now. That interest rate is the rate that basically American banks charge each other to borrow money. It's like, well, if we cut the rate, now it's cheaper to borrow money. And if it's cheaper to borrow money, more people will do it. And if more people have borrowed money, they're buying stuff, you'll keep the economy going. But of course, the big risk here is that normally you cut these rates like during a recession or something like that to give the economy a jolt. And now we keep cutting the rates to try to stave off a recession. So raises the interesting question. Well, when the recession comes, which it will at some point. You can't go forever without a recession. Economies go through boom and bust cycles. Then what are you going to do if your interest rate's already down close to zero? I have an article that's going up on the that's actually up on the website right now that I wrote entitled "Will the Fed Cut Interest Rates to Zero?" It's already down to 1%, and they don't have to cut it much more before it's zero. And if they cut it to zero before this recession comes, they have no tool in their toolbox, unless they do like some European countries have done and go to like negative interest rates where you're actually paying people to please borrow money from me. But you get to that point, and I mean, America already has serious debt problems, and those debt problems just keep getting worse and worse and worse. There's like no emergency savings fund for a recession, which a lot of modern economists say doesn't matter. But when you read through the Proverbs written by Solomon, wisest man ever lived except for Jesus Christ, he definitely makes the point that he's like, even ants know that you save when times are good to have money when times are bad. And America has not done that. So when the next recession does come, it's a pretty safe bet that it's going to be quite a bit worse than the last one.
Something for us to definitely keep a close eye on there. Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. We are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember to visit us at thetrumpet.com to read more about the stories that we're discussing today. Please email any questions or comments that you may have about today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks very much to our panel, Josue Michels, Brent Noctegal, and I almost feel like I should say Andrew Miller's name twice here today for his myriad contributions, but we'll just leave it at that. And we'll leave you today with these words from Leonard Cohen. Poetry is just the evidence of life. If your life is burning well, poetry is just the ash. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.